Bruce Pratt here for another edition of Sportslit 101. What are we doing today, Bruce?
Well, we're taking a second look, and it'll be the last time we look at this book, The Gold in the Rings, The People and Events That Transform the Olympic Games by Stephen R. Wynn and Robert K. Barney. We were just talking not long ago about Follow the Money. The last chapter in the book, right before the epilogue, is called the 2009 Copenhagen IOC Session. Now, people may remember that in 2009, everyone knew or was convinced that Chicago was going to get the 2016 Games. And they would get them because it made a lot of sense, because Barack Obama was pushing it and he and Michelle were incredibly popular, because it made financial sense in a huge way for the rest of the world. And, you know, no one's going to give it to Rio, right? You know, Tokyo's had them before. Madrid, well, Spain's had them too. Tony Kornheiser wrote a piece about how there was no way that any way that it could be lost, because the two reasons why are the United States is getting this one for Chicago, he said. One is that because Obama's extraordinarily popular around the world right now, and two, and most importantly, the answer to all of your questions is money. We prop up the Olympics, our TV money bankrolls the Olympics. That is absolutely true. But what had been happening for years, and Peter Ueberroth should share a great deal of the blame for this, is that people were trying to divvy up the pie in a different way. And the United States Olympic Committee was just on a very high horse and didn't want to play with the IOC. And Juan Antonio Samaranch tried very hard. And through this, all the research in this book shows that he kept his cool. And when Ueberroth finally left and Scott Blackmun took over, the U.S. decided, well, we got to play with these guys. We got to stop. We just lost Rio. We shouldn't have lost it. And we know a couple of things are about to happen. We're about to have the Salt Lake City bid rigging scandal. And Lula, the president of Brazil, will shortly after Rio gets the games end up with a 9.5-year prison sentence, which he appealed, and that became a 12-year prison sentence for money laundering and corruption. So the stink around the Olympics grew and grew and grew. And when Blackmun came in, he really tried to make a difference. He tried to get along, tried to find middle ground, and tried not to constantly insult the Europeans while working to get much more television revenue. Now, there's a group called TOP, and we don't have enough time to go into this, that has to do with corporate sponsors for the Olympics. You have to give a lot of money to be able to use the five rings, the Olympic rings, in your advertising. Not anybody, just anybody can do that, which we learned back when we first talked about this book in the early going, starting with de Coubertin and then with Avery Brundage. There was a move to keep that away from advertisers. You can be an official sponsor, but you can't use the official Olympic symbols. But a couple of things happened. First of all, Obama was not going to go to Copenhagen until he found out that the presidents of the other countries were going. Mayor Daley wasn't going to go, but he decided he needed to go too. They needed to look like they had a united front. However, one of the things that happened is it was a little cooked. The IOC's many different branches, and we have to remember that the U.S. Olympic Committee also has these subdivisions, United States Ski and Snowboard Association, United States Amateur Cycling Association, whatever they are, the governing bodies of each individual sport get some of the money from the Olympics that the U.S. Olympic Committee gets as its share of the television revenues. So it was for a long time to a great advantage for the U.S. to keep driving the price of advertising for the Olympics up, which they did. And it went from $100,000 back in, I think, one of the games in the 50s. It's in the billions now. And Fox and NBC and ABC and CBS and Comcast, all these people were in a bidding war. And what the IOC was saying is, okay, you're going to get all that extra television money. We need a bigger cut. Now, it's still true that the United States pays for more of the Olympics than anyone else. And it's not always true that United States-based corporations are the largest contributors, but banded taken in together, they are. There are European TV channels that get rights in Europe. The CBC certainly does in Canada. There are other ways that the Olympics generate revenue, but what little is left over for some of the very small countries made them not want to go with the U.S. They got tired of the U.S. having the heavy hammer, and so the U.S. was cut out of the Olympics in 2016. However, in 2010, Scott Blackmon realized that he needed to stabilize the relationship between the two bodies, and he went to a meeting in Vancouver where the Olympics were being held and was stunned by the anti-American animosity among all the others. And instead of doing what Ubaroth did and saying, well, look, we play our way. You can either like it or not like it. He said, okay, what do we have to do? How do we work this out? And for a couple of years, he and Samaran kept hammering out deals. They thought they had a deal. Something would fall through. But in time, he, along with some others, was able to make that happen. Larry Probst and then Jacques Rogge, who was had succeeded Samaran. They hammered out agreements that now have stabilized revenues and have stabilized the Olympic funding formula, and seems to have probably cut down drastically on chances for corruption. The reason I'm bringing this one up is that everything in the book leads up to this. It goes through the whole history of how it was rabidly anti-commercial, anti-professional when the Olympics were revived for the modern Athens Games. And every time commerce started to creep in, everybody who was in charge at the time tried to stop it, but eventually they couldn't because the money got to be too big. And we now have professionals. We don't have amateurs in the Olympics anymore. Some of them may call themselves amateurs, but they're at least getting, you know, performance fees and appearance fees and the like. So we've ended the amateur part of it, and we've certainly ended any idea that it isn't corporate driven. All you have to do is look at the ski venues and see the miles of banners for every corporation under the sun. See the names on the inside of the boards at skating venues and at the track and field venues. That's not going to go away. That's going to be here to stay. And we now see how pernicious that has grown to become now part of the NCAA as well. Oh, it's the gold in the rings. It's a really, really fascinating book. It's at times a little dense because they really go into the minutia in a way that makes sense. But I really recommend this to someone if they really are interested in the history of the Olympics.
Excellent, excellent. And next week, you said we'll be talking a little bit about the new book from our friend Jack Gilden.
This book, Rich, is fabulous. Amy Lawrence from CBS Sports wrote, both haunting and harrowing, Jack's detailed account of Spectacular Bid's unique history also serves as a fascinating snapshot of American society in its complicated obsession with the sport of kings. If you thought horse racing was dirty before, it's not. We know what they do to horses. What they do to jockeys is almost as bad. And what Jack uncovered is everything we thought we knew about why Spectacular Bid didn't win the Belmont, not so fast. And it's a really intriguing look at the lives of jockeys, the lives of horse racing wealth in Kentucky and Maryland and places like that. As I said, I'm only about halfway through, and I finally was too bleary-eyed. I had to fall asleep, or I could have read this whole book. It's really, really good.
Next week, we'll talk about it. Yeah, talk about that. I look forward to reading it as well. Sports Lit 101 here on a Wednesday afternoon.